Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. By the year 1900, more Irish lived in New York City than in Dublin, more in the U.S. than in Ireland. My guest today, historian and author James Barrett, says the Irish paved the way for later immigrants to America. They made the mold, he says, for what it was to be a hyphenated American, Irish American, Polish American, Italian American. Today, the day before St. Patrick's Day, we'll look at how the Irish became American and shaped America. This hour on Point, the Irish way. You can join the conversation. Is this your family's story? How would you describe the Irish way of immigration, of becoming American? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from Urbana, Illinois, is James R. Barrett, professor of history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, author of the new book, The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. James Barrett, it is a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Sam.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst and our noble Irishman, Jack Beattie of the Beatties of Galway. Jack, welcome.
Top of the morning. Top of the day.
Top of the day. Top of the day, sir. Top of the day.
And Professor Barrett, to you as well.
It's great.
Thanks.
It's great to have both of you right here. James Barrett, remind us first of the timing and the scale of the wave of immigration whose impact you describe.
There's some Irish coming to New York and to Boston and other places even before the famine. So there is an Irish population in a number of the cities. But the great wave starts in the wake of the famine, which, just to remind people, was roughly 1845 to the early 1850s, maybe 1852. And those people have settled in certainly by the late 19th century. I'm concerned with them, but I was especially interested in the later immigrants and also in the second and third generation in the Irish community and in their relations with other racial and ethnic groups in the city.
We'll look at those in the cities that they were where they were most heavily settled, in New York and Philadelphia and Chicago and Boston and more. I mean, it's kind of astonishing to think that by 1900, 5 million Irish in the United States, and that was more than in Ireland itself, Jack. This was an enormous wave, and the famine that they started in flight from, so deep, so long, so bitter for the home country they left behind.
Yes, and unlike later immigrants, as Jim points out in his book, who often returned to the old country, especially Italian immigrants in the early, they would stay here a couple of years, earn their stake, and go back to the old country. There was no going back for the Irish. To go back was to go back to them, starvation. So they had to make it here. They had to stay here. And that that rootedness and sort of almost multiplied their numbers. That is, the numbers of other immigrants are slightly misleading since there's a kind of churning.
Yes.
But there wasn't any churning with the Irish.
It was hard at home. Jim Barrett, you remind us that before the Irish started arriving in 1840s, you had people who had come to this country, and the categories were sort of settler or indentured servant or slave. That in some ways, the Irish were the first what Americans themselves thought of as immigrants.
Right. Not only did they not have an eye back on Ireland, but they settled disproportionately in cities. The figure from the 1920 census is just about 90%. And That's a bit unusual. It's certainly unusual for the earlier immigrants to the U.S. What it means is that these communities of immigrants were overwhelmingly of Irish communities, urban communities. The writer, a writer on the subject, reminds us that they went from being sort of the least urbanized in Western European society to the most urbanized in the U.S.
Why do you think they did that? You write about the Germans who went off into the countryside and sort of dispersed as farmers. Why do you think the Irish in America tended to stay in the urban centers?
A lot of Germans in the city as well, but you're right. A number of them went into more rural areas. And there's probably a number of explanations, but the beginning is certainly with poverty. Some of the Irish immigrants only managed to get across the Irish Sea into the British industrial cities. Those that made it to the United States were not in any condition to take up land. The other thing which I've been particularly concerned about is the networks that begin to develop pretty quickly, I would say, within that first generation in the city. And what it means is that those networks mean that these people, though poverty-stricken, develop ways to get by. And so I think it's both this negative element of really extreme poverty, not too much to go with, and on the other hand, a community that they came into which allowed them to make their way in the city.
Take us on into that. You describe them as kind of paving the way for other large strands of immigrants later, and you call it the Irish Way. Flesh that out for us. What's the Irish Way you're talking about?
I think that there's some ironies here. One is that the really pretty extreme discrimination on both grounds of nationality, but particularly on grounds of religion, force them back kind of on their own resources. In other words, that are marginalized in the city. That's certainly true in the early stages politically, but it's also true at work and so forth. In other words, quite a bit of discrimination.
In the United States, once they got here, it was no welcome mat. Yeah.
Right. And they developed these networks in a number of spaces in the city. But I think I would actually start with the parish. I think that the Catholic parish becomes a focal point for these communities and those relationships that develop first in modest ways on the docks in New York and in building construction, laying railroad track and so forth, and then probably in more ambitious ways as the political organizations begin to develop. These create a way for the Irish to make their way on an everyday basis in the U.S. And the argument in the book is that not instantly, but over a period of time, as newer people came into the city, first of all, they needed to deal with these networks of the Irish politically and at work and so forth. But also, I think that it can be shown that newer immigrant groups develop over a period of time comparable sort of networks and follow some of the same strategies as the Irish. So what happens, to go back to your question, you develop a very dense network of these relationships, even as the Irish begin to spread out in the city.
You say others may have done it. They may have paved the way. But you see, the Irish proved to be masters at transforming everyday relations into institutions which afforded them economic, social, cultural, and political power, like labor unions, political machines, the Catholic Church, and all of its manifestations, Jim.
Right. So the tip of the iceberg is that they just show up every place. The way I would put it is if the newer immigrants that came late in the 19th century and in the early 20th century, if the black migrants that came in large numbers during the period of the First World War in the 20s, if they wanted to avoid the Irish, that's not so easy to do. They're dominating by the early 20th century, certainly I would say the late 19th century, they're dominating the labor movement. They're disproportionately not just presidents of international unions, but also local activists, shop stewards, the people that are doing the organizing. In the workplace, they're often foremen by that point. In the Catholic Church, they're not only cardinals and bishops, but many parochial priests, teaching nuns in that area, in the neighborhoods, street gangs, local figures of importance. Mm-hmm. And the big story, of course, is the political machine. Tammany Hall in New York City was, I wouldn't say replicated, but certainly comparable organizations were developed really in all the cities.
And we'll look at that all over. And, of course, in the midst of all that, that hyphenated identity, that Irish-American identity. Here's the sound from a 1936 newsreel covering New York City's St. Patrick's Day Parade.
Sure, and it's the greatest day of the year for old Aaron's sons and daughters marching up Fifth Avenue in New York in one of the most elegant St. Patrick's Day parades in history. And divil a bit do they mind the breeze, which is blowing a gale now and then. And look at the colleen, paying tribute to the good saint. And the kiddies, too. Just look at them stepping out. 40,000 men, women, and children parading to heavenly music, music right from the old sod, by a flock of bands.
St. Patrick's Day, New York City, Fifth Avenue, 1936. Jack, with starvation at home and prejudice when they arrived here, I guess it's hardly surprising that the Irish really band together to help each other out.
Yes, and that phrase clannishness almost springs from the Irish experience. And there was, certainly in Boston, a good deal of localism. That is, people from Kerry banded with Kerry people, Galway people and with Galway people, and so on. But early on, again, in Boston, the model was a look at government, not as a way to, in the way, say, Protestant American, Yankee American reformers looked at it as a system of, keeping our republic and dealing with the business of government and so on. Oh, no. The Irish early on looked at government as a source of employment. And that was what counted.
Let's get a job. Jack Beattie, please stand by. We're glad you're here representing the Beatties of Galway. Jim Barrett, James Barrett in Urbana, Illinois, is author of the new book, The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. On the eve of St. Patrick's Day, listeners, you can join us. Do you think of the Irish as the first ethnic Americans, the first hyphenated Americans? Join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook with the Dropkick Murphys here. This is On Point. Now Chris dance and shake and an unmarked grave. A slug full of lead was the price they were paid. Vigilante justice, prejudice and pride. No one in this valley will be seen again alive. 57 men on the hardest mile, murdered for their troubles, left to die. Immigrant sons from Donegal to Rhode and Derry. The numbers were few, but they did the job of many.
Well, it's by the hush, me boys, and sure that's to hold your noise and listen to poor Paddy's sad narration.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point on the eve of St. Patrick's Day, and we're talking about how the Irish became American. Mary Black there with Paddy's Lamentation. We're talking with James Barrett today. His new book is The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City, talking about how the Irish made their way and set the pattern for immigrants who came behind. Jack Beattie is with us as well, and you can join us. Do you think of the Irish as the first hyphenated Americans? And did they show the way for those who followed? Italians, Jews, Poles, everybody. What was the Irish way of coming over, of moving in, of becoming American? What did they bring to America, change in America? How did America change the Irish? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Here's a little bit from the first Irish Catholic president of the United States, John F. Kennedy, 1963, first sitting U.S. president to visit Ireland. And before the Irish Parliament in Dublin, June 28th, Kennedy spoke of the inextricable bond between the U.S. and Ireland.
And so it is that our two nations, divided by distance, have been united by history. No people ever believed more deeply in the cause of Irish freedom than the people of the United States. And no country contributed more to building my own than your sons and daughters. They came to our shores in a mixture of hope and agony. And I would not underrate the difficulties of their course once they arrived in the United States. They left behind hearts, fields, and a nation yearning to be free. It is no wonder that James Joyce described the Atlantic as a bowl of bitter tears.
The Irish coming in hope and agony, said President Kennedy there, back in Ireland, the first sitting U.S. president to be there, speaking there. That was 1963. Jim Barrett, the bowl of bitter tears of the Atlantic, in the words of Joyce. when they arrive in the U.S., you write about them as the first ethnic group. What does that mean?
Right. I think that they're distinct. In other words, they're, if nothing else, they're easy to pick out in the population. They're
Why?
Concentrated. Well, I think it's partly the poverty. It's partly distinctive sort of dress. Coming from Ireland, they didn't necessarily look like the typical American. They're concentrated in particular areas of the city. That gets to be less true over time, but it certainly was true in the immediate wake of the famine. Areas like Five Points in Lower Manhattan, kind of the classic immigrant slum.
I think we saw Martin Scorsese's Gangs of
right.
New York representation of that.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's the setting for Scorsese's film. Even then, you know, it's a bit mixed, but I mean, it's overwhelmingly an Irish Catholic slum neighborhood. And I think that my main argument with regard to this mm-hmm. first ethnic group thing would probably be that they seem to figure out pretty early on, for all the talk of individualism in the United States, that they're not going to make it as individuals. They're really only going to make it as a group with these kinds of solidarities that I was talking about earlier. And I think that's where the hyphenated thing comes in, because I think in a strange way they need to kind of identify first as Irish, which, of course, not all these immigrants did. Many of them are coming from isolated sort of areas and have only local identities. So they definitely identify as Irish and band together and sort of strengthen the community on those grounds. At the same time, they're very concerned about being accepted as Americans, and a lot of these efforts that they're making are toward that end. And I guess it could be argued in the long term that, you know, that happened. But in the meantime, you have a lot of this bitterness and a lot of struggle. So it's a kind of collective identity. It's a hyphenated identity in the sense that they certainly identify as being Irish, but they're striving every moment to be accepted as Americans.
So one element of this way you're describing was simply adopting a national identity from the home country, not County Mayo or Galway or Cork, but Irish. And that's one thing you're pointing to and saying, well, other groups followed that as they came, that localism had to give way to a nationalism, to have the strength in numbers, a collective identity to make it.
I think that it's a common misunderstanding in the way we look at immigrants generally, not just the Irish, that they come with these national identities. But I think the early immigrants in many cases, not just the Irish, lacked that kind of national identity. A lot of the nationalism that we think about, the mass nationalism, the struggles for independence in Ireland, post-date that famine generation. And in the case of many of the other groups, Italy was not unified until relatively late. A lot of the people mm-hmm. coming from Italy are coming from small towns. No Poland before the period of the First World War, partitioned among three great empires. So I think that among other innovations, you know, you get the development of these strong nationalist organizations among the Irish. And, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a perfect model for other groups. I would say that it indicates to other groups that this is a place where you can do that. You know, there's relative political freedom. There's the resources in many cases to begin to do that. And so as the Irish, Kennedy's talking, among other things, there about the struggle for independence in Ireland mm-hmm. and how much of the resources and effort came from the United States. And I think that comes to be true for later groups as well.
Interesting. The American experience making nations of immigrants after they've left the old country. Derek in Boston
right.
is calling. Derek, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, gentlemen. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about maybe the change in immigration laws from that time to today, because we're listening to a sad but also kind of heroic story about the Irish. And it seems that today's immigrants, particularly from Latin America, aren't considered heroic in that same sort of sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about it? Was it really considered heroic then, or is that the patina of history laid over here, Jim?
Yeah, I don't want to oversimplify a very good question, but I mean, to some extent, you know, we're reading this heroism back. I think it's probably important. Jack may have something to say about this to recognize the level of hostility towards the Irish, really throughout the 19th century, and I would say to some extent into the 20th century. So that's one point to make. In terms of anti-immigrant feeling, strong sort of anti-immigrant sentiments really throughout the late 19th century towards the Irish. So One thing that's different, the caller asks specifically about law, and the immigration setup for those wanting to come to the United States, with the exception of the Chinese, is pretty much wide open during the 19th century, and it remains pretty wide open in the early 20th century. There's a very restrictive law that's passed in 1924. We sometimes forget that today. It's a law based on quotas for the various nationalities entering the United States. It doesn't quite cut off immigration, but it certainly greatly reduces it, particularly from those countries where we were receiving the most immigrants at that time. And so to come back to law more recently, most people probably know, but Kennedy had envisioned, and then eventually the law was passed in 1965, a much more open sort of an immigration law. It still had restrictions within it, but it opened the way for what we think about as a second great sort of mass immigration, which is the particularly Asian, East Asian, and Latin immigration of the 1970s and of the 1980s. And that wave, of course, is still going today. But to come back around to this issue of discrimination, to the extent that we're thinking about things in those terms today, maybe the caller worrying a bit about the earlier immigrants being heroic and the more recent immigrants being more targets. Yeah, I would argue that a lot of that has to do with historical memory and the perspective from which we're looking back at those earlier immigrants.
Jeff in South Boston is calling. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to tell, I guess I've kind of spoken on this a little bit already, but my grandfather served in the Pacific in World War II. And when he came back to the Boston area in the 40s and 50s, when he applied for work, he saw a sign saying, Irish Catholic need not apply.
That late in the 20th century?
Yeah, and eventually what he did, he was able to buy and run his own gas station in Watertown. So it kind of shows us the determination of the Irish people, I think.
The determination over a long time, if you're still seeing that kind of sign in the 1940s, 1950s. Jack Beatty, your family knew this Irish way, its own version of it, over from Galway and into America. As you read Jim Barrett's book, what do you make of the coming that he described and the becoming that he described?
Well, I think it was hard for the Irish, and I think one particular element of it that's alive today to their experience. Compared to the experience of Hispanic immigrants today, is that the Irish were in competition with native working men. And that was the root of the know-nothing reaction against them in the 1850s. Remember that in Massachusetts, 350 of the 351 cities and towns elected know-nothing mayors and officials, and their whole platform was send these folks back to Ireland.
These were American-born laborers who saw a first wave of immigrants, more than quote-unquote, and felt their livelihoods threatened.
Their livelihoods were threatened, and of course, then that same fear is felt by the Irish toward African Americans, and especially their reservations about abolition. The Boston Pilot, which was the sort of voice of Boston Irish and Archdiocese, long into the 1850s, was saying these abolitionists, this is just, let's just keep things as they are. They were terribly afraid that their, mere foothold in America would be disturbed should slaves be emancipated and they would have to, come and compete for their dollar. So that experience of just mean in the sense of crabbed circumstances. First, they felt it from the native community, and then they manifested it toward the African-American people.
Jim Barrett, you write specifically about that, and we want to hear that. It's very interesting, but also about how the Irish then met and received the subsequent waves of immigrants to this country, many of them coming into the very cities that the Irish had in many ways wrapped up between governments and union and the rest.
Right. Just to take off from the caller's point, I wouldn't want to minimize any discrimination that people faced in a city like Boston as late as the period he's talking about. Jack may have something to say about this as well. I would think that by that period, the Irish are running a lot of these cities. But to go to your question about the reception of the later people, that's not a happy side of the story. I think that in the early stages of the Irish immigration, again, 5 points in lower New York City is a good place to see this, there's quite a bit of fraternization across racial lines. There is, in fact, quite a bit of intermarriage.
And you're talking specifically Irish Americans and African Americans there.
Right, and also Chinese Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the early end. And,
what years are you talking there, Jim?
You know, starting in the as early as the 1830s, but probably going as late as the 1850s.
Okay.
Scorsese takes some artistic license in the film, but the moment there at the end is the 1863 draft riots. And certainly by that point, if not a bit earlier than that, the situation has changed to the one that you're talking about, where actually I think they're quite hostile towards towards newcomers. The later immigrants, even Catholic immigrants, people from Italy and from Poland, faced a church, just to take that space as an example, really dominated by the Irish. And in the early stages of the Italian immigration, for example, Italian Catholics often found themselves in Irish parishes, which is understandable given the timing here, but they tended to find themselves in the basements of the Irish parishes. In other words, they were allowed to celebrate Mass and to come to church, but not necessarily welcomed into the existing churches. And the same sort of dynamic, I think, is there with the African Americans. And Jack earlier emphasized the competition for jobs. I think you can talk about that to some extent with regard to urban space, in other words, neighborhoods as well. And the Irish tended to have this system where they drew a lot of deadlines in urban neighborhoods to clearly tell outsiders that, you know, this is their community. So I think there's conflict along a number of lines. And as I said, the tragedy that people often refer to there is that you have a community of people that really faced great discrimination along a number of lines as they came in. But they, to some extent, embrace this kind of hostility along racial lines and even to some extent toward newcomers. The book finally comes around to situations where you get countervailing kind of tendencies. Some of those come from the church. Some of them come from the labor movement. Some of them, frankly, come from political machines.
These are justice tendencies or acceptance tendencies.
Right. Sometimes for self-interest, a union trying to organize a place that by this point, let's say the 1920s, has a very diverse labor force is going to need to deal with that issue of ethnic diversity and racial diversity. And there were many labor organizers coming from the Irish community who did that. And Tammany Hall, up to a certain point at least, needed to integrate immigrant Jews, Italians coming into Manhattan, Brooklyn, the other places.
Tammany Hall being New York's very Irish-dominated power structure.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jack, in his work on Curly, tells the story of what happened in New York City. And so I think if I wanted to tell this story about the hostility, I would to some extent balance that with efforts, whether for idealistic reasons or for practical reasons of integrating some of these newcomers as well. And as I say, you can see that in a lot of different areas in the city.
And it worked out differently in different cities. Very interesting. You write that eventually the Irish-American politicians saw they had little choice but to integrate newcomers. If they wanted to maintain power in Chicago, the Irish political machine did that, survived. New York, Tammany Hall, intransigent, and replaced in the 1930s by LaGuardia's multi-ethnic political alliance there. Jack Beatty, you wrote The Rascal King about James Michael Curley, congressman, mayor, governor in Massachusetts, a big rascal. He rode these waves very successfully for a long time.
Oh, he did. He did. And he rode them in two ways, by playing up that no Irish need apply prejudice and saying that's what we're fighting all the time on the one hand, and on the other hand, always appealing to the what he called the newer races and saying, We're with you. You know, we're transcending our Irishness to reach out to you while we're keeping our Irishness in resentment against this, you know, oppressive class here in America.
James Barrett, please stand by. The new book is The Irish Way, St. Patrick's Day, tomorrow. 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
When boyhood's fire was in my blood, I read of ancient freemen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today, the day before St. Patrick's Day, about how the Irish became American and set the pattern, my guest today says, for immigrants who came behind. James Barrett is with us. His new book is The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jack Beattie's with us as well, of the Beatties of Galway, author of The Rascal King, the story of James Michael Curley, one very potent, indeed, Irish-American politician in Boston. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you make? What do you think? Did the Irish make it easier for others or harder? Are the Irish still more into the old country than others? Why? Does the Irish way still work for Mexican immigrants, for Haitian, Vietnamese? What's your Irish immigration story for St. Patrick's Day? 800-423-8255 is our number. All kinds of response online. It's really interesting here. I mean, here's one listener says, I'm loving this, baking my Irish bread and my Guinness cake for the weekend with St. Patrick's Day coming. You know, others say, Pascal writes, you know, since Italian immigrants put up with considerable slurs and aggravation from the Irish who came before them, and it wasn't all by any means easy. Question for you here, Jim, from Tina. She says, it's all caps. Why did the Irish so often arrive in the U.S. and then start beating up people in the African-American neighborhoods? We've touched on that, but there's an angle of this that you bring up in your book, which is really interesting, about Irish performing blackface in this country eventually and being kind of dominating that form of stage mockery, I guess, of African-Americans. What was that about, Jim?
One theory, there's other people doing the blackface minstrelsy that you're talking about mm-hmm. as well. In other words, other groups, native-born people and so forth. But they are very important in that, and here we're talking about kind of more the mid-19th century than right. than later. They're very important. And one theory, which I think makes some sense, is that it's a way for them, it's a form of humor through which they are allowed to distance themselves from racial minorities and from African Americans in particular. And they, of course, had an interest in doing that. They were at some risk of this kind of discrimination themselves. And the theory goes that they worked this out on stage and found another avenue of acceptance through performance, and particularly this kind of blackface performance. Part of it is also that regardless of who's putting on the blackface, and of course this was another tradition that was followed, Jolson's mm-hmm. important film, The Jazz Singer, is a blackface performance in large part. The idea is that whoever is putting on the blackface is able to kind of step outside of their own kind of ethnic racial identity. You know, a crude way of putting it would be that the Irish minstrel with the blackface on was no longer Irish. He was kind of stepping outside that identity. And once you step outside, that gives you some license to practice the kind of humor that you choose to practice. And as you say, that was often at the expense of African Americans, but it could also be at the expense of native-born people and other ethnic groups. And
kind
so
of
forth.
To Tina's question, you're right about how there's an element of turnabout's fair play here, that there had been back in the old country, there had been a similar kind of character portrayed as the Irish character on stage, which was the object of fun.
Yeah, you don't. You find that all over, but you don't really need to go any further than Shakespeare. I mean, you've the comic Irish characters, the person that came to be called the stage Irishman shows up pretty early and quite often in British theater. And, of course, in the context of the United States, you find that again. And sometimes it's the Irish putting on the character of the stage Irishman, stage Irish woman, Bridget, the funny Irish maid or cook. And sometimes it's other ethnic groups putting on the Irish. So the minstrelsy that you're talking about, one way of seeing this tradition is that it morphs into music hall and then eventually into vaudeville. And it's not a coincidence that that the Irish also played a very important role in vaudeville performance. And there's no form of performance. There's no musical pastime that's more popular with immigrants in immigrant neighborhoods, in blue-collar neighborhoods in American cities than vaudeville. And that's a mixture of people. Irish, Catholic, Jewish teams were actually pretty common in vaudeville. But the Irish play a very important role in pioneering vaudeville. And the idea is that some of that comes out of this earlier minstrel tradition.
We've got a little tape here of the Irish-American stage star George M. Cohan. He began his career as a young child in his family's vaudeville performances. Later he starred in a handful of films. Here's from the 1932 film The Phantom President, performed in blackface. Here's a bit of Cohan singing from that performance.
There are reds in Russia, there are whites in Prussia, there are blues most everywhere. Let's string the three together and fly them in the air. You are men and you are free men. Maybe someone ought to wave the flag. Now is when you've got to be men. Maybe someone ought to wave the flag.
Irish-American stage, their film star, George M. Cohan, 1932. Kathy in Quicksburg, Virginia is calling. Hi, Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. How are you doing?
Very well. What's your story?
Well, you know, you guys are getting really, really deep, and I was just going to talk about my great-great-grandmother.
Let's hear it.
Okay, well, she came, the family story is my great-great-grandfather was a Confederate soldier from Mississippi and was captured at the Battle of Lookout Mountain and spent the remaining time of the war as a prisoner. So when the war was over and he made his way back home, he found his entire family dead.
Oh.
Yeah. So he moved to Florida and sent out for an Irish bride, a mail order bride.
Now, was he Irish-American, Kathy?
No.
Okay.
He was Mississippi. I don't really know very much about that side of the family. I do know that he was best friends with Jeff Davis, so, you know, we got that part. But he, my mother and my sister have red hair because of that Irish, you know, the Irish in the family.
So you got Irish in the family by your, what, great-grandfather's kind of desperation. Had to look somewhere with his family gone to find somebody.
Right, but going back to what y'all were speaking about, I just have one more comment before the break. Was, you know, since we are real Southern, I do have to mention that the Irish versus the African Americans for jobs is even mentioned in Gone with the Wind.
Huh.
But, you know, we could talk about that, bro.
I'd forgotten that reference, Kathy, but I appreciate your story very much, and I thank you for it. Let me get one more here. Carrie in New Milford, Connecticut. Carrie, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
Erin Gobrah.
Erin Gobrah.
My great-grandmother also, Ellis Island, we can't even go back past Ellis Island because I guess the name change and all that. But I'm from St. Louis, Missouri originally, and there's going to be a big parade, four blocks of this entire area called Dogtown. There'll be, you know, girls dancing on trucks as the parade goes through, and then everybody goes to barbecues throughout the neighborhood. You can walk and see everyone hanging out on their lawns, doing it. It's just a great celebration because there's a real strong Irish heritage there.
Going to be a real St. Patrick's Day celebration right there, Kerry. I appreciate your call on that. Many around this country still, and it's interesting how alive that tradition stays. We'll look at that. Let me get one more right here from Austin, Texas. Bob is calling. Hi, Bob in Austin. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just found the topic so interesting. A few years ago, I picked up a book called How the Irish Became White. And being a black guy growing up in the South, I thought it was a joke. But as I read the book, it kind of reinforced the notion to me that races actually is a political designation. And when you talk about, your guest was talking about how Irish were reticent about blacks coming into their neighborhoods and taking jobs. Well, I think the guy mentioned in the book that many years ago in the 18th century, they actually hired Irish to do jobs that were too dangerous to risk a slave.
Wow.
I wonder if your guest is familiar with the book, and I'll take your comments off the air.
Bob, I so appreciate your call. I know my colleague Jack Beattie knows this book well, How the Irish Became White. Jack, remind us of the thesis of that book that Bob's bringing to us.
Well, I only know it from the reviews, but yes, the thesis is almost what we've heard, which is that the Irish became white by pointing to the African Americans and saying, they're the black people, we're not. They're the bottom most rung, we're not. And it became almost necessary to their psychic identity that the African Americans stay at the bottom, because so long as they were at the bottom, the Irish weren't. And so long as they were at the bottom, the Irish could make a claim to be white. And that point about the 18th century, that is so well made. Richard Hofstadter points that out in his book, An America in 1750, that there were that you had to invest in a slave, but there was work that an indentured servant could do, or that which basically was the way the Irish came over then, that you would give them, that would be clearing swamps, for example, that would be far more dangerous and onerous. You wouldn't want to risk your investment in a slave. Let some day laborer do it.
Jim Barrett, what about it? I mean, our caller Bob is reminding us about race as a political construction. I'm looking back at this was, of course, Noel Ignatieff's book, How the Irish Became White.
Right.
And I'm looking at one review here that says, of the books, reminding us, says, prior to the Civil War, white did not mean what it means today. That is, it was a mixture of people without regard to national origin, language, or religion. The book reports that white meant people who did white man's work and sort of struggled to stay off that bottom rung to see who would be on it.
Yeah, I think just a couple of quick points. One is what that definitely suggests, which I think is very important to understand, is that the whole notion of race, meaning not necessarily a person's skin color or features, but what we associate with that term. The idea would be that that's really constructed over a period of time. It's not natural at all. It's not biological in its essence. It's the ideas that people have about other people. And in that regard, I'm not so sure about saying the Irish were not white, but I certainly think it's right that in the racial hierarchy of the United States in the 19th century, they were certainly not considered on the same level as native-born, phenotypically white Americans. They were considered far inferior in what would be recognized at the time as racial terms. And part of what's happening with the Irish, this part, an element in the defensiveness and and in the striving, has to do with this diminished sort of perception of them in racial terms, recognizing how important this is in the United States for historical reasons, and coming into contact very often with African Americans in work, in the neighborhoods, and so forth. I think that this racial anxiety, you might say, on the part of the Irish does actually explain a certain element of their mentality.
And the Irish banded together and pulled themselves up. Marie asked on Facebook, Jim, she said, could your guest explain how the Irish separated themselves once they arrived here? Example, lace curtain Irish versus shanty Irish, she writes.
No doubt about it. That I would argue that takes a little while. They're overwhelmingly poverty-stricken in the early stages. But this term that she uses is actually kind of interesting, lace curtain Irish. And as far as we can tell, it really doesn't come into common usage until certainly the late 19th century. And the reason that's significant is that by that point, yes, you were beginning to sort out an Irish middle class. That's coming partly through business. It's coming partly through politics. The educational levels are rising. And I think that this notion of the emergence of an Irish-American middle class is very important, and the distinction that she's calling our attention to is also important. So one of the things that I'm interested in is industrial conflict, and that could often be between Irish-American workers on the one hand and Irish employers on the other hand. By this time, they're foremen, they're straw bosses,
yeah,
they're superintendents. Sure. So there's an Irish middle class.
Jim in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom, what a grand show that I got to listen to today.
Good.
Growing up in South Boston, one thing about the Irish people, now I'm down here in Fort Mill outside of Charlotte, is we still keep a connection, you know, with the old sod. I know in the 70s and 80s and 90s, the bucket would be passed sort of below and behind the bar or the IRA. And today, even with the goings-on at the Irish Church in Ireland, you know, if you get our Irish up, we'll still cause a ruckus, even against our own institutions.
Yes.
It is, you know, in Charlotte too. I'd be remiss to say there'd be a great St. Patrick's Day tomorrow.
Oh, good.
And I really love hearing James and Jack. And if you do me a favor, maybe one of your folks can dig up that Irish goddess Judy Garland singing "It's a Great Day for the Irish" from Little Nellie Kelly.
Oh, I don't know if I can rustle it in time here, Jim. It's a tall order, but yes, those connections back to the old country still strong, and it's interesting. But we've got also Jim. Thank you. But here's a note from Inda. She says, "I'm a third generation Irish American, been living in County Mayo with my Irish husband for the last 11 years." She writes, "Jack, I never realized how not Irish I was until I moved here. I'm definitely all American. I moved here. You know, my grandfather was from Galway, said he'd never, my great grandfather said he'd never go back. She has. Now she sees Jack for all the ties. She's American."
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I mean, the whole, anyone who's been to Ireland, because I haven't been there in 25, 30 years, but and it's gone through a cycle, hasn't it? It's had its Celtic tiger, and now as an Irishman, Irish priest from up there said, now we're basically the Celtic kitten.
Oh no.
But the pace of life is so clearly different there, and the roads are different, and it's not an American. it doesn't look like America, that's for sure.
Well, it was the Irish way, as James Barrett describes it. It was not always an easy way, and in that struggle together to come through, we can see a lot of the reasons for celebration that comes back out on every St. Patrick's Day, and we really appreciate that. James Barrett at the University of Illinois in Urbana, Illinois, author of The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. It's been so great to have you, Jim. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Jack.
Jack, always great to have you, and best to the family back in Galway next time you do see him, Jack.
Aaron Gobra.
Aaron Gobra. Thanks for joining us, listeners. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.